Look up idiot in the dictionary. You know what you'll find?
A picture of me?
No! The definition of the word idiot, which you fucking are!
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to I Do Movies Badly, a podcast exploration of my cinematic ignorance. I am your host, Jim Rohner, and despite being an amateur film critic since 2006, I am woefully ignorant of many films, filmmakers, and genres that consensus has deemed important. And thus, I have created this podcast to document my journey into cinematic edification. This month, I'm exploring the films of John Carpenter, as recommended by Reed Lackey. And this week, I'll be wrapping up John Carpenter month with his 1994 film, In the Mouth of Madness. Excuse me. Before I get into that, I just wanted to not even address any housekeeping per se, but just say that if you celebrated Thanksgiving, if you are listening to this in a place which observed Thanksgiving, I certainly hope that you had a wonderful Thanksgiving holiday. I, for the first time in my life, had two Thanksgivings, Friendsgiving specifically on Thursday and Friday, both of which involved good food, good people, and good dogs. So that was all well and good. And if you are now returning back to work on a Monday or a Tuesday, I'm recording this on Monday. You are probably listening to this on a Tuesday. Either way, I'm sure it's back to work for all of us, and I'm sure that we're all dealing with that in our own way. Although if you are listening to this podcast in a country or an area that does not observe and celebrate Thanksgiving, there's nothing out of the ordinary for you. And back to work just means exactly what you did last Thursday and last Friday, so it's completely insignificant. Speaking of complete insignificance, In the Mouth of Madness, huh? I don't mean in the sense of this film being insignificant, but certainly some of the themes that it hits upon, which I will get into because that is a great segue. We just say what everyone else is thinking, what everyone else already knows. In the Mouth of Madness is the best H.P. Lovecraft adaptation on film that potentially exists. And by potentially, I mean definitely exists. I don't know why my brain came up with the word potentially. Although, what the interesting thing is, this is the best Lovecraft adaptation, film adaptation that exists, even though it is not actually based on anything. I say that because if you're a fan of Lovecraft, you see the influences kind of worn on the sleeve. They're all up there on the screen. And if you're not a fan of H.P. Lovecraft, or you don't know a whole lot about his writing, I'm sure that even doing some research, even, you know, regarding interviews or reviews, or hell, even just on the Internet Movie Database trivia page, you'll see all sorts of things, references and homages to H.P. Lovecraft. H.P. Lovecraft is, coincidentally, my favorite author of all time, not just in regards to the genre, but also just in regards to his writing style. H.P. Lovecraft was is a favorite of mine. I've read all of his stuff over and over and over again. I've listened to podcasts on his stuff. I've read essays on his stuff. He is my favorite author. And so, In the Mouth of Madness, I was sort of predisposed to like this movie, and if you remember when I was talking to Reed, this is a movie I've seen before, but a long time ago. I think it's been 7-8 years since the last time I saw it, and even at that time, I wasn't as into H.P. Lovecraft as I was now, so I was interested to see how my viewpoint had changed on it, how my opinion had changed on it, what I saw in it before, scenes that I may have forgotten about, which I was reminded of, so this was an interesting viewing experience, not the least of which because being a fan of Howard Phillips Lovecraft and being someone who has kind of found more appreciation of his work the older I get, I also realize that as a film fan, a lot of Lovecraft adaptations are straight up terrible. Let's be honest with ourselves about that. The best of which is, of course, I don't think there's any argument, Stuart Gordon's Reanimator is a wonderful film. But a lot of Lovecraft adaptations, especially a lot done by Stuart Gordon, because Stuart Gordon seems to have quite an affinity for Lovecraft stories, but most Lovecraft stories, I don't know why, when they are adapted to film, are pretty terrible. Whether they're in short form, whether they're in long form, there's something about, I don't want to say intangible factors, but there's something about the themes that Lovecraft deals with which makes it very difficult to adapt into film because a lot of his stuff, relies on your imagination filling things in or your imagination visualizing certain things, or at least based on your experience and how you view and engage with the world. It kind of relies on a subjective experience of the world in order to kind of really bring you dread and terror, because a lot of his stuff, yes, it involves creatures and it involves unspeakable things and disgusting, shapeless masses that exist on the edge of the universe, but it also involves existential dread and sort of cosmic insignificance, which is something which is very difficult to adapt onto film, to show visually. How do you really engage with that? How do you make that scary? How do you make that terrifying? You know, you can include an other with a capital O, you know, a monster, a creature of some kind, but the scary things in Lovecraft's work are not necessarily the shapeless things. It's more what the shapeless things represent or where they come from, what their source is, and what their presence means to the existence of our characters. I didn't intend to start out this episode getting into detail about Lovecraft, but I might as well, because I think I have to lay down this groundwork in order for my both praises and criticisms of In the Mouth of Madness to really make sense. So, I don't know how long, but I guess if you are familiar with H.P. Lovecraft, with his work, and you know how this film is saturated by him, then I'm sorry, because in these next few minutes, I'm going to be talking about a lot of stuff that you know already. But for those of you who don't know a whole lot about his stuff, I want to give you a little bit of a primer, I guess, on the themes and the motifs which are common in his work, because once again, I do think it's vital for you to sort of understand that in order for my criticisms and my comments on this film to really make sense. It might not mean anything to you, these things may not matter to you, but something I'm trying to kind of, you know, really grasp and kind of become more intentional about is, like, this is my podcast, and I kind of have to assume if you're listening, you're listening to kind of get my thoughts and my opinions on this. So these are my thoughts and my opinions. So let's start out with a little bit of a primer on my favorite author, Howard Phillips Lovecraft. So basically, wow, now that I plan to talk about this, and I'm not even really sure where to start, but basically what it comes down to is Lovecraft was a staunch atheist, and also was he developed a literary philosophy called cosmicism. And I'm just going to quote this right out of Wikipedia, because someone else has wrote this and explained this better than I could. So cosmicism, essentially, Lovecraft was a writer of philosophically intense horror stories that involve occult phenomenon like astral possession and alien myths. I don't even know what that word is. You know what? I'm already ruining this. Let's skip ahead to the principles of cosmicism. The philosophy of cosmicism states that there is no recognizable divine presence, such as a god in the universe, and that humans are particularly insignificant in a larger scheme of intergalactic existence, and perhaps are just a small species projecting their own mental idolatries into the vast cosmos. This also suggests that the majority of undiscerning humanity are creatures with the relative significance of insects and plants when compared to the universe. So basically, the trademark of pretty much every single Lovecraft story, not every one, Reanimator is certainly a little bit different, The Hound is different, you'll find exceptions, but the kind of the Lovecraft's bread and butter in regards to his short stories were you have a simple yet not an unintelligent, but a rather unassuming protagonist who in some way, shape, or form, whether it be exploring their ancestor roots or exploring a new geography or going down some type of rabbit hole which kind of brings them out of their geographical and emotional comfort zone, discovers some type of larger universal truth about essentially their own, not just their specific insignificance in the universe, but the insignificance of mankind, of humanity, of Earth in the larger scheme of things. That includes kind of a destruction of the paradigm of what they're used to, or a complete breakdown of the knowledge, the scientific and religious knowledge that they had, you know, come to be comfortable with. By having all these facts and thoughts and philosophies defied by the exploration and the discovery and the realization that humanity, mankind's existence is completely insignificant, not just meaningless, but completely insignificant, almost sort of a mistake, a cosmic and universal mistake in the realm of existence, and that all facts and science that we seem to know is not that it's fake, but that it is has been laid down and created by these humongous, uncaring alien-type life forms, which are thought of by primitive societies as gods because of how powerful and indifferent and uncaring they actually were. I'm sure even if you don't know Lovecraft's work, you've heard the name Cthulhu. But you know, Cthulhu is one of Lovecraft's quote-unquote gods. Weird names like Cthulhu and Dagon and Azathoth and Yog-Sothoth. These are all creatures who are ancient, who have existed before time, who existed before our universe came around, and who are so old and so powerful that they just don't care about us. They have no reason to care about us. They have, in some form or another, kind of touched our plane of existence, but they sort of exist outside of what we know of as space and of time. And so the discovery of this fact by these finite, minuscule, insignificant people often result in complete madness, excuse me, or suicide. Because it's this general idea that there is a truth that is so outside of what you as a finite human being can comprehend that the only logical response is for your brain to break or for you to feel like there is no point in going on, because if you are insignificant, what is even the purpose of your existence? Here's another thing I'll quote from Wikipedia. In Lovecraft's Cthulhu stories, it is not the absence of meaning that causes terror for the protagonists, as it is their discovery that they have absolutely no power to change anything in the vast, indifferent universe that surrounds them. In Lovecraft's stories, whatever meaning or purpose may be invested in the actions of the cosmic beings is completely inaccessible to the human characters. And now, you may be hearing this and thinking, that's all great and kind of freaky and scary, but what does that have to do with In the Mouth of Madness? Because In the Mouth of Madness doesn't really deal with those kind of things. It hits upon the others, which Sutter Kane brings those up as late in the movie, the forces which are inspiring him or forcing him to write the stories that he is writing in order to kind of pave the way for their entrance into our reality. But it doesn't really get into mythology, it doesn't get into gods, it doesn't get into these larger, grandiose themes that I just talked about. And that's all well and true, that is all true, but it still does hit upon this idea of the inability of a character who is faced with the maddening reality of his own insignificance and his own inability to change anything, recognizing that and kind of going mad from that. That is something which is tantamount, which is central to Lovecraft stories, and that is something which I keep wanting to say At the Mountains of Madness, because the title In the Mouth of Madness is an homage to Lovecraft's, arguably his greatest and certainly his longest story, at the Mountains of Madness, which I'm still holding out hope that Guillermo del Toro gets to make his adaptation of that. But and that's because like I said, In the Mouth of Madness wears these influences and the homages on its sleeve. On the surface level, you have stuff like just words and titles. I mean, Mrs. Pickman, the old creepy lady in the inn where Trent stays, is a reference to Pickman's Model, a story which, hey, here's some similarities, about a guy who is able to craft art, horrific, terrifying art, because he sees it every day in real life. He sees these real characters, and that is why he is able to model or sculpt these horrific and horrifying models. Some of the dialogue in the movie is pulled straight from stories such as Rats in the Walls and The Haunter of the Dark. And even the names of Kane's books are sort of winks and nods to Lovecraft stories. One of Sutter Kane's books is Whisper in the Dark, which is pulled right from Lovecraft's A Haunter of the Dark. So it's Carpenter and Mike DeLuca, who wrote the script, they make no bones about saying, like, yeah, this is an H.P. Lovecraft story. This is straight up a story inspired by the work of H.P. Lovecraft. And I love that. I love it because I think it is, as I said, the most successful Lovecraft adaptation in the sense of at least helping to kind of visualize some of at least the superficial things that you see in Lovecraft stories. You know, this small, quaint New England town, which seems picturesque, but has some type of really horrifying and really dark, you know, secret kind of underneath it. And you have this idea of this new or this ancient mythology, is the ancient kind of power which has existed before even religion that we know about it, and that is in a way coming back and overtaking what we know of religion, and this idea of people, you know, trying to grasp or trying to come to grips with this reality and being completely physically and mentally unable to do so because it breaks down and destroys every single paradigm, every single philosophy, every single I don't even know what I'm trying to describe it, but it essentially breaks down everything that we know, every certainty, every truth that we have. It tries to break it down, and you at least have that stuff sort of on the surface. Everything is sort of like in play there. You know, you sort of have all the pieces that are put together, and you think it would work. And I said this a bit about Escape from New York. This idea of like there's a lot of pieces in play that sort of like, okay, this is on paper, this should be a good way to tell the story. This should be a good way to kind of, if we're going to make a good adaptation of a Lovecraft story or a good spiritual adaptation of a Lovecraft story, this is the way that we're going to do it. We're going to have this intelligent and very pragmatic protagonist who's going to come into this small New England town investigating what seems like a sort of simple mystery, but as he digs, he discovers it goes much deeper, both in regards to the roots in his most immediate vicinity, and also just in the larger cosmic scale. And you're going to have some type of larger force behind all this, which is, you know, pulling the strings or the machinations are being controlled by something which is beyond this man's comprehension and which is beyond this man's power. That's going to drive him mad. And that stuff is all there on the surface. But it still doesn't work for me entirely as a film. Because like I said, this is In the Mouth of Madness does a great job in recognizing the things that make Lovecraft stories great, in recognizing that these are the things that are truly terrifying, because it's not just a thing which is jumping out at you, or there are plenty of things that jump out at these people. It's not just that, but it's also this idea of when confronted with your own insignificance, when confronted with the truth that your reality is a lie and that you have no ability to change your world. You are not in control of yourself. You are not in control of your world. Your life is at the hands of a larger, darker, more sinister power, and you are just a pawn in a game. Essentially, when confronted with the idea of the loss of free will and acting because that has been predicted and decreed, well, that is a horrifying thought to me. Just thinking of, like, I have no agency, I have no purpose, I have no significance. I am insignificant. That is to me more terrifying than any masked killer chasing after me. That is more terrifying than you know, any type of mutated animal. That is more terrifying than a spirit lingering in my apartment, which is throwing things around at me at night. That idea of existential insignificance is fucking terrifying to me. And In the Mouth of Madness at least recognizes that and tries to engage with that. Carpenter and De Luca do more than just try to scare you with creatures. They try to scare you with philosophy, which I applaud the two of them for attempting it, but I don't think they do it very well, and I don't necessarily think... Some of it, I think, has to do with Carpenter, and I'll get into that in a little bit, but I think a lot of it also just has to do with the fact that adapting Lovecraft well is hard. Because, especially in a mainstream horror film, And yeah, this was a New Line Cinema joint, so this was still, I guess, technically an independent film production, but not art house independent. This is still like kind of, you know, indie mainstream, you know. In a mainstream horror film, you have to deliver scares, you have to deliver tension, you have to deliver fright, you have to deliver things that are going to keep your audience engaged and kind of keep their blood pumping and keep them guessing. And a lot of that has to be visual. It has to be things that you see. It has to be things that creep you out. It has to be things that scare you. It can't just be existentialist dread. You have to deliver a visceral experience. And it's very difficult in film. How do you visually depict existential dread? How do you visually depict the internal turmoil, the internal machinations? How do you sufficiently depict someone going mad or someone confronting their own sanity breaking without kind of being that over-the-top guy in a straitjacket as Sam Neill is, screaming that he's not insane? Depicting existential fear, depicting fear which isn't just rooted in fear of something that's around the corner, of something that's going to jump out at you, of something that's going to physically harm you, that's incredibly difficult to do when you're trying to deliver a film which also has to be viscerally satisfying as well. You know, you can certainly do this, I think. I think a great Lovecraft adaptation can be made, but I think it has to be made in the art house or true indie world in which a filmmaker and an actor is not afraid to linger on things, to focus on expressionism and focus on sort of things that exist just on the edges of things, you know, without having to necessarily show things. Because part of the thing that I love about Lovecraft and about his writing is he relies on vague physical descriptors in order to sort of have your mind fill in the blanks and just kind of piece together, like, okay, he's giving me this weird description, but if I put that together, that doesn't look like anything. That doesn't look like something I'm used to that I would see in nature. And that's because it's not supposed to be something that you see in nature. It's not supposed to be something that you see in this world, in this existence, in this reality, because they come from outside of our existence. They come from outside of our reality. But how do you depict that? How do you tell an art director? How do you tell a makeup artist like Greg Nicotero, hey, make me something that doesn't make sense, or craft me a model of something which you will never see in this world, or is not derivative of anything that you will find in this world? That's a difficult task to do. And then tell your actor, hey, so all religion, all philosophy, all science is all wrong, and action. That's hard. That is a hard thing to do. And so I don't think it's necessarily a problem with Carpenter and with Mike De Luca, but I certainly think that Carpenter, who is a guy that does action very well, that does viscera very well, that does pulse-pounding kind of genre stuff, keeps your blood pumping, he might not have been the best guy to try and bring that sort of dread to life. And the flaws here are not blatant, or at least the flaws are not anything that I think makes the movie bad, but just sort of are sort of very clear that they're band-aids trying to cover up the fact that they're compensating for something. Like for instance, Sutter Kane is sort of a hollow character, and he doesn't have to be he doesn't have to overshadow our hero, but at the same time, Sutter Kane is, as a character, he's sort of halfway between being a MacGuffin, but then also being the focus of the story. It would have made more sense of him being a MacGuffin, and we just sort of had, you know, John Trent kind of getting into this quest to kind of find him, and then, you know, doesn't discover him until later, only to see that the one interaction where he's giving a speech about how he's just sort of the voice of the old ones, and the old ones have been using him. But then even after that, Sutter Kane comes back, and he's sort of haunting Trent's dreams, and it sort of seems like he's supposed to be this sort of omniscient, all-powerful guy, but he's not really the threat because there's something bigger than him. Like, not that I need to know anything about him, but the focus on him isn't clear as to is he significant or is he just sort of insignificant. That's kind of muddled for me. There's too many montages, which I guess is, once again, kind of harkens back to this idea of how hard it is sort of to depict this terror that they're trying to go for. And so I think they try and make up for it by just splashing, you know, montages of scary or freaky images. You have a lot of freaky images which are creepy but don't really seem to have much purpose or application. I'm thinking of the freaky kids who are chasing around the dog, the crazed villagers. I mean, it's a lot of stuff which is like, hey, these are scary images. The old person on the bike in the middle of the night when they're driving there, they're creepy images, but they don't seem to make much sense in regards to the context of what is the significance of Hobbs End, and what is the significance of Kane as an author, and what is the significance of this larger philosophy. They don't make much sense. And I think they're just trying to compensate for the fact that they don't meditate on this idea of this existentialist dread very much. To me, I think the film shows its hand too early in the sense of there's something that could be really interesting of this idea of, so Trent gets to this town of Hobbs End and he kind of sees like, oh, so it's, you know, he's writing about this town of Hobbs End because we see the town of Hobbs End. It's not as though, you know, there's... I'm not describing well, but basically I think there could have been an interesting thread of, was this town being created by Sutter Kane, or did Sutter Kane create this town? I just said the same exact thing. The question of, did Sutter Kane create this town, or did this town already exist and Sutter Kane is just imitating it in his art? That idea of, you know, that question could have been really intriguing and could have kept me engaged, but instead it reveals pretty early in the film, you know, pretty much almost right away from that old man on the bike, from the kind of mysterious transportation from the dark highway into the town in the middle of the day, kind of immediately signals into, yes, there is something supernatural and crazy going on here. Which then kind of shows a hand, and then just sort of makes Trent look kind of foolish, because it's very clear to us, and it's very clear to his female companion, whose name is unfortunately escaping me, that there is... that are in over their heads. And so Trent just kind of looks like an idiot because he's going around kind of denying this for a while when it's so clear from the beginning that this is something that's weird. And I suppose there's a Hitchcockian thing of tension about like showing you the bomb first and then showing the characters who are unaware of it. But that doesn't really work here because it's not as though we are aware of it and nobody else is. Everyone else is aware of it except for our main character. And he just kind of comes off as a bit goofy and foolish and ignorant in a certain way. And I think I've read stuff from him before, but I'm going to call on Roger Ebert to kind of express what, you know, the quarrels I have with this. So this is from his review of In the Mouth of Madness, which I will post on the Facebook page after this episode goes up. A couple paragraphs here, so bear with me. He says, the notion of a book that drives its readers mad is intriguing, especially in a movie where no one thinks to take it off shelf. But after the heroes arrive in Hobbs Corner, and I believe it's supposed to be Hobbs End, but he wrote Hobbs Corner, what we essentially have is a horror house movie in which the protagonists creep along while creatures leap at them. The novelist Sutter Kane does eventually show up with lines like, more people believe in my work than believe in the Bible, but not much is done to develop him, and the movie does what no horror movie can afford to do, which is to play tennis without the net. Stories like this need rules. It's not enough to send the beleaguered hero on a roller coaster ride through shocking images, which I completely agree with, because there's something intriguing that could come from this idea of exploring this existential dread and really building up this is it real or is it not real kind of thing, until eventually there is a big reveal at the end that, no, everything you think you know is wrong. And there's not enough buildup because it tells us right away, yep, this reality is not real. This is something supernatural. This is something crazy. This is something outside of what we believe to be real and to be existence. It tells us that right away, so there's no buildup to that. So when Trent is finally made aware of Sutter Kane and what Sutter Kane is and what he is able to do, there's no emotional oomph to it because we knew that already. And that's where I think that the movie fails. And I don't like doing that, like, well, here's how the movie should have done it better. But I am just saying that it didn't work for me because of that, because I do think it plays its hand or it shows its hand too soon. But once again, that is sort of also in a way a testament to how hard it is to depict Lovecraft stuff well on screen. That is an incredibly difficult challenge, and it could just be that Carpenter was not the guy to do that. Having said that, at the same time, there are still sort of the quintessential Carpenter-isms in this movie. There's a little almost kind of throwaway line that a newscaster says when shit is really hitting the fan. He says, when does fiction become religion? And there certainly is something which is, yes, very interesting about this philosophical idea of if enough people believe in a lie, then what is reality and what's not? We kind of hold on to this idea that there is something, that there are some objective truths. But if enough people believe in something, does truth then become sort of a subjective thing? And I think that that's amazingly prescient, especially these days in this political climate. And I'm not saying one thing or another about one political party or another, but when discussion and dialogue essentially breaks down to one side versus the other, and even facts become more ammunition for your confirmation bias, you eventually get to a point in two extremes where one person believes one thing about reality, about their existence, about what is right and what is true, and then the other person believes their own thing about what is right and what is true and what is reality and what should be reality. And I think that that's an amazingly prescient thought that he had back in 1994. Not saying that John Carpenter was looking ahead to the political climate of 2016, but I think he certainly sees something in that idea of the masses holding on to some type of truth, and whether or not it is right or whether it is good or whether it is actually true, turning that into a reality for them. And we saw this in Escape from New York. We saw this in specifically Assault on Precinct 13, about this idea of, well, this is what I've been told about urban areas. This is what I've been told about a certain demographic of people. Whether there is evidence for or not to support that, that is what people believe and accept to be true, no matter what the facts may be. And so philosophically, I think it's still very much in line with what Carpenter stands for and what he represents in his films and what he deals with. And also, there is still, despite the fact that it wouldn't seem like it because of a lack of authority figures, but there is still that anti-authority streak in this movie, but it's sort of been turned on its head a little bit. Because rather than have the authority figure be police or the army or gangs or whatever, the authority in the mouth of madness is fate, is existence. And while we don't have a Snake Plissken, who is sort of the anti-hero because he's a bad guy or he's a criminal that we want to see succeed, or we don't have gang members, or while we don't have a cop sort of acting out against, you know, whatever, what we do have are people, or at least a person in Sam Neill's character in Trent, trying to fight against this idea that he is not in control of his life and failing. And so there is this idea of an anti-authority streak, and we kind of want Sam Neill to succeed. We want to believe that he is in control of his life, that he is not being dictated, or that he is not just, his life is being written for him. We want to believe that about him because we want to believe that about ourselves. We want to believe that we have control over our lives. We want to believe that we have free will. We want to believe that whether it's philosophy or the universe or science or religion, that there is nothing controlling us, that there is nothing predetermined for us, that we can do whatever we want. We want to believe that, and it seems like Carpenter wants to believe that, but what is terrifying about In the Mouth of Madness and what is terrifying about that idea in this world is that it is not true. There's a desire to rebel against authority. There's a desire to be an individual. There's a desire to be free. And yet in the end, that's a lie. That is a terrifying thought. I am a religious person, and I certainly believe in powers that are greater than me. But I also like to believe in the idea that there is choice and that there is free will and that not everything is determined. Which is why, for me, cosmicism, why the idea of my personal and as mankind, the idea of our insignificance is absolutely terrifying, because you are robbed of all meaning, you are robbed of all purpose, and when there is no purpose and there is no meaning, what's the point of really doing anything? That's a terrifying thought for me. So I'm not going to read a Lovecraft book or a Lovecraft short story and be up all night, you know, worried that there's something under my bed or that there's going to be something standing in the corner if I wake up in the middle of the night. But I will lie in bed, you know, maybe not sleeping for a little bit, because I'm thinking like, hey, is my reality real? That's the kind of shit that keeps you awake at night if you think too much about that. And that's the kind of movie that In the Mouth of Madness wants to be, but just can't bring itself to be, because I think that there are limitations on Carpenter as a director that kind of holds this movie back from being that. But at least this movie is aware of that, acknowledges like that terror that is outside of just creatures, outside of just, you know, some opposing force, and asks the question like, hey, wouldn't it be really terrifying if everything meant nothing? And that's ambitious, and that is admirable, and so I have to appreciate that at least tries to do something. I could keep going on and on talking about H.P. Lovecraft, but I'm not going to do that because this episode is done with. In the Mouth of Madness, if you care to watch it again, if you care to try and pick up how many Lovecraft references you can pick up on, you can certainly do that. It is available for rental or purchase on Amazon Prime, or I should say Amazon Instant Video, rental or purchase on Vudu. It is available on iTunes, I think, only as a purchase. And this is something I just discovered today. Apparently for rental or purchase on a service called Fandango Now? I'd never heard of that before, but apparently you can also rent movies through Fandango. So that's fun. So plenty of ways for you to get your hands on it. And there's also plenty of ways for you to get in touch with me if you want to share your thoughts on this movie, if you want to share your thoughts on John Carpenter, if you want to share your thoughts on anything, easy enough. Shoot me an email at youdomoviesbadly@gmail.com. Find me on Facebook at idomoviesbadly. Nolan Fixes Teeth on Twitter. Go to battleshipretention.com or iTunes to catch up on back episodes and leave some comments, if you will. And so with the close of this episode, that of course brings us to the close of John Carpenter month and the close of November, which means that next week is December, which means that next week is a new theme. But also, as is the case, and I apologize for this happening all the time, I'm not really sure what the theme for next month is going to be yet. I certainly have an idea. I am going to be pursuing that idea this week and certainly letting you know. But a combination of initially being lazy and then getting busy later ultimately leads me to this unfortunate circumstance in which I am unprepared, at least at this time, for a theme next week. But there is going to be a theme next week. There is going to be a theme next month. I'm just not sure what it is yet, but please do stay tuned, because I'm sure it's going to be a good one. So this is normally where I'd have my sign off and saying that be sure to tune in next week, where I'll be talking about something. And we'll hopefully I'll be just a little bit less ignorant and a little bit more prepared.
This program is a proud member of the Battleship Pretension Fleet.